This podcast takes you into the rarely discussed realm of the personal decisions leaders have taken that have influenced their business decisions and developed them into the leaders they are today. The refreshingly honest experiences of those who have been very successful provide an insight into the challenges they faced, the successes they achieved, and the people who influenced them along their journey. Here's our host, Mark Silvera.
Welcome to Business Made Personal. This podcast is brought to you by the insurance industry's leading education and events provider, ANZIF, via their Careers in Insurance initiative. I'm Mark Silvera. I've got Jody Sharman with me today. Jody commenced her insurance career in 1999 before starting her own insurance agency in 2004. Now, Jody ran that business for 18 years. She employed 7 staff before merging her business with Gallagher in East Melbourne in 2022. That's a move, she says, has given her a new lease of life on business. Jody was also a finalist in the 2020 Advisor, Top Insurance Broker and Top Thought Leader categories and sits on the NIBA Victorian Committee. I'm also pleased to announce that Insurance Business recently has awarded Jody as one of the Elite Women in Insurance 2023, which is awesome. Welcome to the show, Jody.
Thank you for having me.
I always ask this question of people. Give us a bit of your backstory before insurance.
I grew up in a semi, I'd say, country area just outside of Melbourne called Greenvale, and my parents owned a service station. So during my primary school years, my parents decided to teach me the value of money and wanting things, and that meant that I had to work to get things. So I started my career quite early at the age of 10, and I would tackle off with Dad to work at 5 a.m. in the morning and come back at 6 o'clock at night and do a full day working out at his service station. That's where my work career did begin originally at the age of 10. But then I did go on at the age of 13 when I was in year 7 at school and start my first proper paid job at the bright $5.15 an hour when you're 13 at McDonald's. And I did that whilst I continued through and finished year 12. So that was a five, six years at McDonald's.
Obviously, you've got this sort of work ethic as part of your whole background. Why do you think that's the case?
It's funny. I stop and think about it because I have a lot of people ask me about this all the time. And I think, you know, my dad was always he just liked to train people that if you worked hard for things, you could get things. So if I wanted those Reebok pump runners that were $200, you know, 20-something, 30 years ago, that was a lot of money for runners. You couldn't just go and buy them. So you had to work for that. So it was a work ethic that was sort of instilled to us at an early age that you could get things, but you have to work for it. So, you know, he taught us from a young age, saving money was really, really important, you know, so that you didn't have to pay, you know, if the more money you had when you went to buy a house, the less you'd pay in interest rates, in repayments and stuff like that. And it's funny, I never will forget my mum said when they first got married at 21, she was made to give nearly all of her pay to my dad in savings. It went away into a savings account. So she earned $111 in a week. And Dad would take 100 of it and save it. So that gives you a pretty clear idea of how the savings worked in our house. You didn't get very much to spend. But in hindsight, I look at the life that we had, and we had, you know, we had a great life. We had a big house and, you know, we had all those things. And I think that was because Dad worked so hard to get those things.
And thinking about those days, given the fact your father worked so hard, how did the whole parenting thing work for you? I mean, did you feel that you needed more time from your family or from your parents, or were they there for you?
Great question. My mum was absolutely there for us every step of the way. She was on every committee at every school or every sport that we were associated with. She actually is the person that created and went to the council and opened up Greenvale Basketball Club that's still running 25 years later. You know, she did that to get youth off the street, and I trained there 7 days a week. I also ended up playing some high-level basketball through my younger age. So my mum was there as part of the way through all of that. But funny enough, my dad didn't even stay up. Didn't come to a game. I played for Victoria, and my dad was not able to attend one sporting event because he was working 7 days a week. Yeah, so that was the cost.
And those sorts of things, and look, I can relate to that a bit because, you know, being a son of migrants who came here with $50, my parents had no choice. But you were alone at some of those events, right? I mean, the good thing is that you had your mum there. So,
yeah, I was very lucky that Dad basically was the one that went to work 7 days a week, and Mum was at home with us, you know, driving us to every single thing that we had on. So, yeah, at least I had one parent, which, you know, I feel blessed to have had.
Just thinking about those younger years, was there someone that was super influential for you and they had some traits that you actually admired and aspired to?
Yeah, so my grandfather, I'm thinking of my dad, and then I think of both my grandparents were very successful in their own. My mum's side, my grandfather owned and operated Australian Mine and Quarry Supplies, so that was all the supplies of different parts for crushing equipment. You know, and I watched my grandparents travel the world, South Africa, and live a great life themselves. It was, again, instilled from my mum's side, you know, work hard, you get good rewards later in life and you can, you know, live a quite happy life. And then my granddad, which is my, on the shaman side, which is my dad's dad, he started in the mail room at Australia Post all the way up in Mildura. And then he worked his way through Australia Post and was the state manager of Victoria, you know, running the Melbourne GPO in, you know, next door to Meyer in the city. So yeah, I remember going to his retirement dinner and seeing all the people and, you know, the people that had been a part of his life. And I think I was 10 or 12 when he retired. And I remember seeing the impact of what his work life had on people and how many people just loved him. So he did retire at an early age of, I think it was 50, 55. And he actually then, you know, there's 9 grandchildren and he ended up driving us all people to school or picking us up from school. And again, I was working at McDonald's and I'd see him at 3 o'clock sitting there watching me have a coffee and his 6 chicken nuggets because, again, he was proud to watch us working at such a young age. So, again, you can see the work ethic was instilled probably from the grandparents down to my parents and then passed on to me.
So speaking of all of that, let's talk about work ethic. And it's interesting you mentioned Australia Post because when you were talking about that, I'm thinking I probably worked for him because I used to deliver the phone books back in the day, right?
Phone books? Unbelievable.
You used to carry 6 in each hand and beetle up and downstairs.
I remember my parents waiting for them, like to get the new updated one.
Let's talk about work ethic. You employed 6 or 7 people at when you were running your own business. You're now working at Gallagher, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. Do you think that people these days have the same work ethic that you were brought up with? Or because I don't think you're unusual for your time, right? So
it's hard to find them. I'll give you that. I definitely had my fair share of people come through that definitely weren't on the same page as me. But one of the biggest things, I always remember my dad said to me, and he said it various times, and it's something that stuck with me forever. He said to me, if you look after your staff, the money will come. He always said that. So I think he always paid a little bit above, gave them extra bonuses, you know, would do nice things for them. I remember he bought one a car. So those types of things that he did for people came back twofold because I think when you're looking after people and you're not just looking after them, that means you're looking after their family. They respect that. And funny enough, in one of my jobs in my early career, before I owned my own business, I had a boss that was quite hard, really, really hard, went to war. He was a tough cookie. And I get he had a very different life than what I had. So he had his way of working. And I just remember working with my work ethics and working stupid hours. And there was a scheme that I ran that had 600 clients due in November. And I would work every single weekend, a Saturday, Sunday. And then I'd work, you know, there was a public holiday in there. I'd work. So for like 4 years, I worked, you know, literally 30 days straight. And I'm not talking 8-hour days. I'm talking 12, 14-hour days to get the work done. And then in the December, like, and I never asked for an extra day off or anything like that. But then in the December, one of my granddads passed away. And I said, I need to just have this week off. And he said, sure, well, you need to put in annual leave for it. And I was just like, are you kidding me? That impacted me. And I went, oh my God, I'm never going to be like you because that's just so harsh. I just wouldn't do that to someone. And, you know, you can obviously feel from the way I'm talking, my grandparents were everything to me. I still, up to the age of 32 when the first one passed away, I still was having dinner every Wednesday night at their house. I'd go from work to dinner at their house and my family, we'd have a family night. I still on Saturdays see my grandma that's alive. She lives in the next street. So I'm very big about family. So when you tell me that the award says that that's not your direct parent, you have, you know, you have to put leave in after what I'd done for you, it also goes back sometimes to management. And I don't, you know, I feel that I never wanted to be that manager. And then in my work life, you know, for the last 18 years as being a business owner, I made sure that I feel I looked after my staff. I was compassionate. And I feel that they gave me everything that they could. I've got one on leave right now on the 30th of June. Her husband booked a holiday. She said, I'm really sorry. I know it's the 30th of June. And she's still online. Like I'm literally writing to her saying, I'm ringing IT to disconnect you. We're done and dusted for 30th of June. And she's seen a couple emails come in and she's still logging on. I mean, get out on the slopes. She, you know, she's just done, you know, she's just done 14, 15 hour days for the last month getting everything ready. I am literally having her disconnected this morning. It is hard to find, to find those people. But I feel if got the right manager and they're in the right team, I think it should all gel.
And I think too, from managers, you can learn equally what to do that works as well as what not to do. Those sorts of things stay with you for the rest of your life. I know you've mentioned your dad a fair bit. Are we able to talk a little bit about him? Because I know he was super influential in your life.
Yes, he was. He was massively.
And from what I've read, he suffered a little from depression.
We had a lot of up and downs over the last 10 years of his journey.
Do you know what sort of prompted that in the first place and how did that impact the family?
He actually, so talking about work and work ethics and getting to where he got in his life, he decided, you know, that he was going to work so hard that at 40 he was going to retire, and he did that. So he got to his goal and at 40 he decided to retire. Then after a couple of years, he, you know, he opened a nightclub and that was great, a great life on the weekends and that type of stuff. Yeah, brought in great money and again, you know, continued fun place for friends to meet, and he became a property developer. But being a property developer, you have lots of ups and downs with properties and tradies and things going wrong. And he did his whole life suffer from OCD. He had OCD, there's no doubt about it. And if things went wrong, it would cause him to go into sort of like a, you know, a form of depression. And then over the years, it got worse and worse. In the last year leading up to when he took his life, it was at a point where he was fighting with a council over some glass bricks in a pavement. So the council had sent him a letter, and the letter had said to him, you know, he was responsible for removing the glass bricks in the Camberwell building. And his OCD kicked in, and in his head, he made himself believe it was going to cost him $1 million. Not that he didn't have $1 million, but again, it's a lot of money and he just couldn't get his head around it, and he spiraled really, really quickly. Unfortunately, he took his own life because of it. So,
was he diagnosed with having OCD?
He was diagnosed with OCD. He was diagnosed with depression. He got through depression about 6 years earlier and he'd got on some medication and it really worked. He was seeing psychiatrists and psychologists and he got good, but he decided that I'll windle off him and I'll just live my life good again, which I highly don't recommend. Because I've just seen that, you know, he, again, sort of something went wrong and then he crashed again, but then he went back to the medication and those medications didn't work. So it's interesting how your body can change over time and not everything works for, you know, again, for the same person. So for him, he couldn't get himself back on that right track. Interesting enough, he spiraled so quickly and everything happened so quickly that after him passing, obviously me and my sister inherited the building and the risk, and he actually wrote about it in his suicide note to not transfer it to us until the issue was sorted. And we hired a lawyer and the lawyer found something in the council's notes that said we weren't responsible for it. So, I mean, $2,000 and we got out of it. In hindsight, you know, 3 months later, we're removed from the issue. So it's something that it's hard for us to deal with. We've sold the building since. We don't want anything to do with the building. I don't want to see that address because not that I can say that the building caused my dad's death, but it led to the end of his life.
Well, you know that saying, you know, it's hard to remember to drain the swamp when you're up to your proverbial and alligators, right? So obviously, and look, thank you for sharing that with me. The reason I asked the question is because I know that you are a staunch advocate in the whole mental health area. So it was my lead-in question to talk more about that and to find out what it is that you're doing, because you've been involved with a few different groups. You know, you've been involved with Open Parachute, Outside the Locker Room. I'd love you to share a little bit about that with us if you could.
Obviously, Dad's death really impacted me and, you know, I've got this work ethic of work, work, work. And then Dad dying, I went, you know what? What am I working for? I know I'm working for my children and a future and school payments and everything else. And then I went, he's dead. And it really impacted me. And I thought, he's gone into the ground with absolutely nothing, left all this money here, and he's gone. And there's no way to bring him back. So I then changed my mind on my life set of life and went, I'm not working forever, hence why I sold to Gallagher. And I want to help people. I want to do things. I don't want families to feel what we felt, because we feel it. And I tell you, 4 years on, we still feel it. And I see the impact it's done to my grandmother. She's never been the same. So what we're trying to do is get involved with organisations and try and help change things. The first thing we did was Open Happy Days Donuts and Coffee, which is my husband's business. That's been created around the 51 Chevy. Unfortunately, that's the Chevy my dad took his life in. So again, a massive impact to our family. I've dealt with that, but I want that car to bring joy to people's life, because that car brought my dad a lot of joy. That was his favourite car. So my husband's created the donut van. And we do a lot of events and we get hired to AFL and all these types of things. And we got hired by Open Parachute to come to the launch of Guy Sebastian walking from Wagga Wagga to Sydney. And in that walk, he raised $1 million for Open Parachute. And that stemmed where we walked from was a place where, unfortunately, a 12-year-old took her life during COVID. So, again, what we're trying to do is raise awareness. And what Open Parachute does is amazing. They've got a program that can be rolled out in the school. So there's a psychologist that I can connect people to if they're interested. And she will speak to the school about rolling out a 20-minute program in any year level from grade prep all the way to year 12. There's different levels of work that's rolled out, whether it be talking about phones and bullying or just including people, all those types of things. So it's like a subject, English, maths and stuff like that. It gets rolled out in the school, all fully funded by Open Parachute. So that was what being involved and going up to do that was one was about. And then the other one that I am involved with and still involved with is outside the locker room. And so they do sort of sporting events, but they go in and talk to clubs about suicide awareness. They have the training and the skill set to do all of that. They get a lot of government funding to do all of that. But again, it's going into schools, workplaces, and rolling out sort of mental health programs and telling people it's okay to ask for help when they're not okay. So that's what those two have been about.
In fact, what we'll do is we'll put the links at the bottom of our podcast for people that want to find out more, which would be great. I'll change tack a little bit now and talk a little bit more about the business side of things. You started in 1999 and then, what was it, 5 years later, you decide I'm packing my bongos and doing my own thing. How difficult was that to do, Jodie?
Well, in hindsight, when I look back, I don't feel it was that difficult because of my age. I didn't have children. I was about to get a mortgage, but back then the wages were probably a little bit different. So in hindsight, the way I looked at it, I was earning a $60,000 wage. I was running a massive business, a book with three staff underneath me for another company. I can do this by myself over here. And Marsh actually approached me with the AR model that they had just created. It was a new thing they were doing. And the way that it was sold to me was, we're going to give you a $150,000 book to start with your cut. Your first year, you're earning 80 anyway. But, you know, the money wasn't going to be an issue because I was potentially going to earn more with the current book I was getting. And then anything that I wrote moving forward from that, I was doing a lot of new business in the other role where I was previously, was a bonus. And then, you grow your book. And then as you get bigger, you can get staff and all of those things. And it would be my own. For me, it was a very easy choice to make back then when I was 23 with really no financial issues. Yeah, I was young. And if it went wrong, I thought I'll just go and get a job somewhere else. That was really what was in the back of my mind.
So let's talk about that. 23 years of age, you're going into businesses and advising them on their insurance portfolio.
I was very lucky for my first 12 months. I was able to run under our state manager of Marsh Advantage, which was Travis Kemp. So he had, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years experience in doing that. So for every meeting that I went to with my portfolio, it was his book. So I really, to be honest, got to learn from him going through a renewal questionnaire with a client, what to look for, all of those types of things. So it was quite small stuff that I was doing. When I say small stuff, I was doing small ISR, small businesses, you know, clients spending $500, some, you know, the biggest program I was running, I think they were spending $20,000 or $30,000. So I was learning in that space and then able to grow. And obviously over the years, I got bigger and bigger and have a lot bigger clients now. But I was learning on the job with the team that I was given also at Marsh.
So at what point did you decide, I now need some help?
When I was at Marsh, they had a lot of training courses and stuff like that. So I was doing all of the ISR trainings and listening to other departments on how they were operating. And then I noticed one saying, I'm better off on the road because I'm a better salesperson and I need someone here that can do what I do. And hearing that just come out of someone's mouth in one of the meetings, I went, I need to start hiring people because that's what I want to do. And from that day on, I literally just started to employ people. Jocelyn, who was my first staff member, is still with me today, 19 years on.
I want to talk to you about your decision to then sell to, let's call it a corporate, because Gallagher is a global operation. Was that a difficult thing for you to do?
Not really. I'm going to be honest. I was definitely at a point where I had approached Marsh sort of a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, after Dad had passed, saying, I don't want to be a leader anymore. I'm happy to be an insurance broker. I don't think I want to be that. I need some more help. I need some more management to come in. You know, I've got 800 clients. Do I want 800 clients anymore? I feel I've given them everything I can give them, their programs. I think they've got the best program, the best coverage, the best wordings, best pricing that I can find at the moment. I want to step back in some way and I want to focus on this mental health stuff. I want to help people and I want to do some other things, but I still want to broke. And unfortunately, Marsh and I couldn't come to an agreement on some things. And then Sarah Lyons called me from Gallagher and she flew down that week to see me. And within half an hour of hearing Gallagher's vision, who they are, where they're going, I actually was pinching myself thinking this is too good to be true. It was like I asked for God to send me something and it appeared in front of me. I actually came home saying to my husband, half of what she says is real. This is real. And every single thing that she said actually has happened and is real. So it was just meant to be.
And it's easy to look at someone like yourself and go, wow, you know, they've been really successful in life and how things have worked out for you have been since fantastic. I want to talk a little bit about failures, if I could.
Been a few of those over the years.
Yes, I want to talk a little bit about that because often we don't get to that point. But how has a failure or an apparent failure set you up for, you know, reviewing how you do things or for, let's call it, later success?
So it's interesting. I didn't know how I would tackle failures in being a business owner. But one of the things and the quotes that I always have always gone back to because I was a basketballer and massive Michael Jordan fan. I wore 23 thinking I was playing like Michael Jordan, but clearly not because I quit at 18. One of the biggest things he said is that he, you know, missed 1,000 throws and didn't win every game he played in. So, but he got back up and he tried again. So I've always had that in the back of my mind at every time I've either lost an account or missed out on a new business when you feel like you've done everything possible and you know their broker's not doing the right things or you know you've given them the guidance that they should have had, that you know they're missing BI cover and or you've pointed out deficiencies in programs and then they still stay with that broker. It is heartbreaking. You sort of go, oh my gosh, why am I doing this job? Like, you know, I've just wasted all my time. I've spent 30 hours on this. It does hurt. It definitely hurts. But then I remember, you know what? It's not my decision. It's out of my control. And I've always got to remember it's out of my control. And I have to just try and do something different next time. I don't stop. I will go back. And it's funny, the one or two that I really impacted me that I thought I've got, and then I didn't get. 2 years later, we went back and we've now had them for 10 years. You know, sometimes it's about relationships and education in our area. You know, you've got to break a relationship. People have been to, one of my clients that is with me now went to school with their broker for 20, and they've been with their broker 26 years. To break that relationship's massive. But it's a challenge for me, and I do like a challenge. I don't like failing, so I will go back. I just try and sit back, reflect, and think, how can I do something differently next time? And there's always something I do find when I stop and switch off and I look, I'm like, okay, I could have done that differently. And maybe that would have been the difference and change in the decision in the end. So, yeah, failures, I just think you've got to pick yourself up from and keep learning and try again.
So you made an interesting comment there, which you said, I've just got to remember that it's not in my control. Now, I don't know you very well, Jodie, but that doesn't sound like something you would accept easily.
I know it's not, but that's what I have to keep telling myself. That's how I get through. Those are the words I sit and I say to myself, it's out of my control. And I've got to stop and I'm going to put that to the side and move to the next thing. And then I do. I'm pretty good at that because I do have a lot of things on my platter. So it's okay. I can move on now.
Yeah, that's it. You got something else to do, I'm sure. I want to talk a little bit about your basketball career in as much as what were the lessons you learned from that you then brought into your business life?
Being a team. It's funny enough, you're talking about basketball. My team's coming here tomorrow from my under 14 teams. We won the premiership 30 years ago. We're having our reunion tomorrow here at my house. We've got all the team coming. Our parents are all coming. And so that's just to show that 30 years on, we're still friends. And I think that that's what sports is about. And it's such a very important part. I've got two children and I've got my kids in sports. And I just think it's such an important, valuable lesson in life to be a part of a team, to be able to share, to go through ups and downs. You learn all of that in those younger years and then you definitely bring that into work life. It's funny enough, if I look at someone's resume and, you know, I have hired probably 15 people over the years, one of the things I look at is a work ethic. Have they had a part-time job and have they been able to look at it? But I do look at have they played sport? If you've been in a sporting team, you know you've got to pass the ball. You know you've got to turn up to training. You know you've got to do those things. So if you can do those as a teenager, you should be able to put that into your work life. And it's definitely something I look at in resumes because I just think it moves into your career path.
And one of the things you've done very, very well is to, not specifically because you've wanted to, but a lot of people know you. You've had a lot of exposure. And, you know, this recent award with Insurance Business, where you're one of the elite women in insurance, sort of underlines that, right? How do you think that sort of exposure, let's call it fame for want of a better word, has changed you personally?
I think it's probably made me more humble. I do think it's made me more humble. I do have a lot of people reach out. You know, it's interesting. I've had insurers reach out to me and ask me to be their mentor. And, you know, it's interesting because I wouldn't have thought that they would come to me for something like that. You know, they're older than me, not that age matters. And I thought that they were already in a good path in their career, but they clearly weren't. So it's interesting. I normally take sort of 3 to 4 people a year where I will mentor them. And, you know, I'm mentoring some people through Neva and I'm mentoring some people through Gallagher. You know, people that are in certain divisions that don't want to be in that, they want to be a broker. So we're working, you know, they're coming to renewal meetings and seeing what we do. But I just think it's good to give everyone a chance. Yeah, so I'm very open to talking to people and meeting with people because I don't know if I had a lot of that probably when I was younger. Don't think that mentoring, if I look really back, I had the person at my at Marsh, but I didn't really see a platform for it where it's very, you know, I just opened up the Neighbor magazine yesterday and there's a platform in there and there's two times a year, put yourself, you know, into the drawer and you'll get given someone and, you know, you have eight meetings and all of those types. I've gone through that probably three or four times with Neighbor. So I think doing that's fantastic and I think it's good for the individual person. And it's funny, I don't tell anyone anything different. I believe everyone should have a five-year plan. I've had a five-year plan my whole life, even down to the type of car or the area or the type of house I want. You know, I may not have met it, but I got there eventually. You know, funny enough, I can tell you now, my dad had Porsches and I wanted a Porsche at 30. And I didn't get a Porsche at 30. I got one at 38. I got there eventually. And I'll remember that day because I went with my dad to buy it. And it was a super proud moment for me, but I got there. And this is what I teach people in those meetings about. And I'm hoping that I feel like I'm an approachable person, irrespective of my success and what I've done with my life. I hope that I'm approachable enough for people to come and ask me, talk to their children now, you know, that are finishing school and trying to find some guidance in where they want to go. But my biggest thing is you've got to like what you do. You can't just go to work for the money. You know, the money's one thing, but happiness is such an important part. If you can't get your brain right and you're not actually enjoying what you're doing, you're not going to be good at it anyway because you don't have a passion for it. So for me, that's what I try and dig in and try and find in people. And I'm hoping that you called it fame, I call it success, allows people to approach me and I can guide them in finding that because I just think that's the end goal in life.
And I guess it leads me to another question around people coming into the industry. You know, there's this, let's face it, we're not the sexiest industry in the world. However, when people get in, they rarely get out. And it's not because they're trapped. It's because people find that it's very, very different to what they expected it to be from the outside.
100%.
In terms of attracting people, you've employed a few people. What do you think we need to do? What do you think is the message that we should be getting out to people to say, hey, consider this as a career because?
So funny enough, you have asked this question. I've just joined a committee, another committee that's been created by Neighbor. It's called Promoting Insurance. And it's exactly to do this. We've got a mission statement getting launched this October. We're talking about going into schools. We're talking about, yeah, so I've done some school settings. So I go to my son's school every year. There's a career expo and I know some other people in the Neighbour area in the committees are doing that. We're using the banners that I've had created and I get insurers to give me some freebies and, you know, I've created a flyer. I've had myself, I've written, you know, just a, you know, like a quarter page on me. I've got someone that's an insurance assessor. And then I've had Anita Lane who, you know, who was an underwriter and owns her own underwriting agency now create her little story about life. Because the way I try and promote insurance is always needed, whether it's insurance assessors, insurance claims managers, insurance brokers, underwriting agencies. There's such a whole wide variety. So I try and make it bright and colourful to attract people to my stand. And then, you know, on my brochures, I've got photos of myself sitting in Hawaii with Janine Ellis because I run Boost Juice and I get to travel the world with Boost Juice and do some really cool things. So I try and show them the parts of the job that they may not realise actually happen. And it's interesting, from that career expo, the last one that I did, I had about 15 parents really interested at the start. They said, oh, insurance broking sounds boring. I said, just have a read of this. Just spend a minute having a read of this and, you know, take some free socks from Chubb and grab a stress ball from Arch. And the impact that came back from that, I think they don't understand what we do. And I think we need to do a better job of doing it. And I'm hoping this launch that we have in October and that will, you know, be going out to unis and schools. And, you know, I'm even asking for it to, you know, sort of be telecast and be in newspapers. I just think it's the world's best secret. And all my friends now wish that they had followed. They're like, I love your life. I want to be an insurance broker. And I keep saying to them, it's never too late. You're going to have to take maybe a little step back and not earn as much money as you're earning now in your current career because you're 40. And you've got to start back down here, but you won't be up. It won't take that long to get higher up the ranks. And that's the good thing about insurance. I don't think if you are smart, good at what you do, and you do put the hours in, you can end up, you know, within 5 years being in a really, really strong position in the industry.
I want to talk about the sale of your insurance agency into Gallagher. You've now been at Gallagher for a year?
No, 7 or 8 months now. It's only 7 or 8 months, yeah. November 7, we moved across last year.
Yeah, okay. So knowing what you know now and knowing what you've done with JLS, what are the main differences between running your own business and being part of a corporate?
The biggest thing for me was, you probably can tell, a little bit of a control freak. So I have been running all my own finances. I run my books. I don't let anyone touch my money, which meant I did payroll, I did super, I do tax. I'm like my own little agent of myself on the side after insurance broking hours that I log on and do all of this paperwork. And, you know, I'm not fantastic at it. I've learned how to do it. But again, just because I like to be in control of things and see where everything is and see how the business is running, I've continued to do that. And with 7 staff, I could. Going to Gallagher, I haven't had to worry about that. So to be honest, that's been absolutely fantastic, not having to worry about doing a BAS every month and paying the tax man all this money. Not my issue anymore. That's definitely been one less stress for me because I have now been able to probably put those 5-10 hours back into my work week, which is resulting in our growth where we're at a 30% growth already. And I think that's due to probably having more time being put back into the business. So, you know, other business owners may not suffer that because they would be smart and probably hire someone that they could trust to do something like that. Yeah, but again, that probably a decision, maybe not a smart decision that I made the last 19 years to do that because I'm seeing the reward for not having all of that side hustle paperwork to do. But also, like, you know, being a business owner, you have the stress. You know, you lose an account, it costs you. I want to show that our team are as good as, you know, they thought we were coming in. So, you know, that hence why we're going as hard as we can to try and smash some big targets that we've set. I can tell you now, I wrote a list as a business owner, negatives and positives for keeping it and for selling, and selling list outweighed. And that was where I definitely made a decision. It was time for me to just do it.
And do you think that's a question of timing as opposed to opportunity? By that, I mean, you know, you've run your own business for quite some time and the timing might have been right where it does sort of sway you more to going, you know what, I don't want to work as hard as I have done for the last 19 years. Did that have anything to do with it?
It did. I want to, you know, 100% because, you know, you don't switch off when it's your business.
I've got a couple of final questions for you, Jodie Sharman, if I could. The first one is, if you were to, and I know you've done some mentoring work, but if you were to give some advice to people considering a career in insurance, what would you say to them and where would you suggest they start?
I would suggest even asking insurance brokerages or writing to insurers and seeing if they've got, you know, most places have a graduate program now or are looking for young talent to come through the ranks where they'll train them up. I would say make sure you don't touch your phones. That's a big thing for us people to see, people that are actually interested. If you're always on your phone and stuff like that, it's not a good look, especially for the younger generation. I find, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-olds have been on their phone, so they don't know any different. So I'm very big about making sure, you know, use your phone. But, you know, from 9 to 5, if you're actually sitting at your desk, don't probably be using your phone. It just doesn't look good. And ask to learn. I'm always saying to people, once you get into insurance broking or being in an insurance place, try and ask someone, try and sit along, try and attend meetings, try and do different things so that you can learn. I'm coaching some people at the moment that want to own their own business. They want to go from being an employee to being, you know, I've had sort of 2 or 3 in the last couple of weeks come to me and we've sort of created a plan for the next 2 years. And where they're working, they have so much resources that they should be tapping into. There's training courses, you know, there's certain other departments. I don't want to say too much because many people may work out who they are and who they work for. But there's so many different things in the corporate organisations where you can tap in and learn from. So there's a placement facility. You know, there's a premium funding facility. There's a trade credit area. You know, I'm saying to these staff, go into every one of those departments and learn. If you want to own your own brokerage, you've been broking for a certain amount of years and you don't have the confidence to do it, learn as much as you can because once you're out on your own, you're on your own. That is the key too. So to get to that stage, I feel you've got to have minimum 5 years broking experience, sometimes a bit more than that. I say to people, you're dealing with people's lives. So if you don't insure them properly, they lose. You could make someone lose their whole business, their whole livelihood. So I think you need to be very confident and ready. You need to understand products and understand exactly what products do and how to address a risk. You know, it's interesting. I quote business and 99% of what we do, we get. And the reason what it is we don't quote if they have a good program. I actually will walk away. And it's funny, it's not often I actually would find someone. There'd probably be 3 or 4 programs a year I'd look at and I'd say it's well created, it's well priced, it's well broked. I'm not even going to look at it. They've done a great job. But then the rest of the time I find programs. I literally have built my business based on finding deficiencies in current programs. Say learn, learn, learn. I don't know one person I could say in this industry that knows everything. There is something to learn all the time. Just learn as much as you can.
Went out on my own many, 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 many years ago. There was no such thing as an AR network that you could lean on. There was no such thing as a Travis Kemp at Marsh that could help you out. You know, you didn't have that sort of support. You're genuinely on your own. And in my case, I used to get the white pages or the yellow pages and make 100 calls a week to try and get a few appointments. Whereas these days is very, very different, which is really pleasing, as you said, for people that want to be involved and have that level of enthusiasm.
And I think also once I say to new people, once they're broking and they're trying to build their business, I say to them, if you're confident and you're in that position and you're ready to become an AR and do that, the next best thing is asking anywhere you spend money to buy from you. You know, I ask the fish and chip shop where I buy fish and chips for my kids. I ask the milk bar back in the day, you know. My theory was we would be sitting in restaurants and my friends would be like, are you going to ask them to quote their insurances? We've been here for half an hour. And I was like, oh, shut up. Give me another hour. You know, my theory is that everybody buys it. So why not let me have a look at it? It's a free review. At the end of the day, if I'm not cheaper and I can't come up with something better for you, you stay where you're at. It doesn't cost you anything. And I think that's a point people need to be really comfortable with to go and do that. And if you went at that point, then you're ready to go out on your own.
Hey, I've got one final question for you, Jodie Sharman, who corporate manager at Gallagher. If I asked you to describe yourself in 5 words or less, what would those 5 words be?
I'd say loyal, reliable, loving. I'm like a little bit of a teddy bear. Giving. I like to give. Hardworking.
Jodie, it's been an absolute pleasure having a chat with you. Thank you so much for taking the time of sharing not just your corporate life with us and your business life, but also your personal life. I really, really appreciated the honesty and the passion that you showed in this podcast. It's been awesome. Thank you for being on Business Made Personal.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for lending us your ears. Please remember to click follow on your podcast app or subscribe at bmppodcast.com.au so we can give you a sneak peek of our next guest. Until next time, I'm Mark Silvera, and you've been listening to Business Made Personal.